Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to the program. My guest today is Dennis Hayes, President and CEO of the International Earth Day Network. Dennis is the author of numerous books and articles, but he's probably best known for having been national coordinator of the first Earth Day when he was 25. During the Carter administration, Dennis directed the Federal National Renewable Energy Laboratory. He's been a visiting scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center, a senior fellow at the World Watch Institute, an adjunct professor of engineering at Stanford University, and a Silicon Valley lawyer. He's served on dozens of governing boards, including those of Stanford University, the World Resources Institute, and the Federation of American Scientists. Internationally, he's recognized for expanding Earth Day to more than 180 nations. Dennis Hayes, very, very welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Well, Helen, it's a pleasure and an honor to be on the air with you.
Oh, thank you. You've got an interesting background. First of all, can I ask you how old you are now?
Sure. It's 25 plus 40. This is the 40th anniversary of Earth Day this year.
Oh, wow. So you're 65. And you started off by being... Did you an engineer and then moved on to becoming a lawyer? Is that what it was?
Well, it's a little bit peculiar. I've taken some engineering courses, but ironically, I've never received a degree in engineering.
Mm-hmm.
The role that I had at Stanford was an interesting one. They had done a poll of graduates of the Stanford School of Engineering with master's degrees and found that within 3 to 4 years, almost none of them were doing any engineering anymore.
Oh.
They had moved into management, and because the engineering requirements are so very difficult, most of them had never taken a course in economics, finance, organizational behavior, marketing, any of the kinds of things that they now had responsibilities for. So in some sense, we lumped a bunch of that stuff together into a course, tied it into what you might do in the renewable energy field, and gave them engineering credits for learning how to engage with consumers, with the public, with their subordinates, with their accountants, and with regulatory agencies.
So is that, Dennis, how you got into the environmental movement and became concerned about it through that avenue, or were you already there?
No, in fact, that happened... Long after all the rest of this stuff in my life, I was doing this at Stanford after I'd left the Carter administration.
Mm.
I got into a concern for the environment in a way that I will summarize fairly swiftly, but it's a long story. By the age of 19, I'd become enormously disenchanted with life as I knew it, the classic late teenager Weltschmerz. At that point, we were having enormous problems in the United States. We were in a war in Southeast Asia that I didn't support. We were having great problems with civil rights. We continued to have the shadow of the Cold War looming over us. We were doing important research in chemical and biological warfare. And I was in a small paper-making community. I was upset about all of these things. But was utterly impotent to do anything about them, so took off and went hitchhiking around the world for 3 years, literally just sort of trying to find myself. Before I'd left, I'd taken a course in ecology and had mastered all the basic principles, but I'd done it mostly as an academic exercise. And one day in what is now Namibia, I'd hitchhiked back from a small town on the coast called the Luderitz, and got back to the main highway heading north-south. My guy that picked me up was heading north, and at that point I was continuing south. Nobody picked me up after that, and I went out over the hill and on a kind of incredibly clear, starlit, moon-filled night that you only get in the desert, suddenly a whole bunch of things just came together in my mind. The essence of it was that everything in the world is subjected to the principles of ecology, and the driver behind all of that is a scarcity of energy, the availability of food captured through photosynthesis. Humans had taken a detour away from all of that just over the course of the last couple hundred years since the Industrial Revolution, as we began to tap coal and other fossil fuels. That was bringing with it a huge number of problems. And I resolved that night that although it would not bring in a paradise, you could make extraordinary improvements in the human condition if we began to submit ourselves to those same principles of ecology that governed monkeys and gorillas and orangutans and chimpanzees, and probably ought to be getting that last primate as well. We didn't have a vocabulary for it at that point. This was an awful long time ago, but it's now what you would call urban ecology or industrial ecology. I literally left the following morning knowing what I wanted to do with my life, came back, went to Stanford, and ultimately got involved and spent career in it.
Isn't that fascinating? You really had an epiphany. It was sort of like Jesus being in the desert for 40 days and 40 nights in a certain sense.
There is a certain something that that you see this pattern repeatedly in all the different kinds of basic faiths, where people go out, they get very hungry, they get enormously hot and cold and lonely and get these epiphanies in my own sort of non-religious way, but probably with a pretty strongly laden environmental value system, I had the same sort of thing.
And it's interesting that you worked with President Jimmy Carter. I know David Freeman, who was also working with Jimmy Carter. Did you know him at the time, Dennis?
Oh, sure, and knew him before the time when he was working in the natural gas industry. Then under Carter, he went to the Tennessee Valley Authority.
Mm-hmm.
David has been a good friend for a half a century.
Yes, he's fascinating, isn't he?
He still wears the cowboy boots and the cowboy hat.
Yeah, he's a very funny fellow. In fact, just to give you a bit of what I've done, I held a conference called Nuclear Power and Global Warming for 2 days in Washington, D.C., and David was there, plus people from both sides. And at the end of, you know, going through these ghastly statistics about nuclear power and global warming, he stood up and said, "We can generate all the energy America needs by 2050 with no nuclear and no carbon." And I said, "You must be kidding, David." He said, "No, we can." So I raised some money and we employed Arjun Makhijani, who's a brilliant physicist, to examine the present situation technologically and economically. And we came out with a wonderful document called Carbon-Free, Nuclear-Free. And indeed, although Arjun was sceptical to start with, he was absolutely amazed that, in fact, this is totally doable. Do you know that document?
In fact, Arjun also is an old friend, and he sent me a copy. I have been so consumed with this Earth Day organizing, but it's sitting on a stack in my office along with a few other volumes that I plan to dig into.
I know the feeling. So, so you started Earth Day in 1970. What were the dynamics that brought that about, Dennis Hayes? And how did you organize it at the time?
Well, the origins of the whole thing were a series of speeches given by a senator, Gaylord Nelson from Wisconsin, calling for an environmental teach-in on the nation's campuses. I was a graduate student at Harvard at the time, and I hadn't really heard anything about it before I heard of one of his speeches, but it seemed to tie into that value system that we discussed earlier that was all rooted back in Namibia. And so I, with all of the arrogance of youth, flew down to Washington and got a courtesy appointment with Senator Nelson, assuming I could probably get the charter to organize Harvard, but thinking I might even get the charter to organize Boston. And in the course of a conversation, he started talking about how his office was getting more response than his Senate staff was really able to deal with and still serve the people of Wisconsin, and that he had decided to set up an organization with a Republican congressman, Pete McCloskey from California, and old basically start organizing this in some place that actually then had some substance and some direction. And in the course of the conversation, it came out that I'd been at Stanford University and pretty active on a number of things and started making a series of suggestions about what he might do next. It turned out that McCloskey, his co-chair, was the congressman who oversaw Stanford, and one of the board members that he had was Paul Ehrlich, who also was at Stanford.
Yeah.
And so I was kind of connected to the inner sanctum of this, though I didn't know it before I arrived there. And I went back with the charter to organize Boston, and 2 days later had a call saying, would you consider dropping out and coming down to organize the United States? It sounded like much more fun than what I was doing. So.
Oh, really? How wonderful. And so now you and he worked together. How did you do it?
Well, in fact, for all kinds of reasons, including that this was what D. Hawk refers to as chaotic organization. We had a basic value system and a set of things that people were expected to do, but there was no way to control the spontaneous things that would be going on in thousands and thousands of places across the country, some of which might well be things that the senator would rather not be too closely involved with, because there were some very strong activists involved in this. So the two of them remained as the co-chairs, and they raised most of the money for it, but it was a very hands-off kind of operation. We brought in a bunch of people who'd cut their teeth in the anti-war and the civil rights movements, and one who'd been a feminist. And they applied those organizational skills that they'd acquired in other things throughout this. I mean, one of the important things to remember about Earth Day, it was 1970. It was just coming out of the 60s, a unique period in American history where a lot of people really knew how to put together events. So I hired these key regional organizers, sent them out across the country. They found a huge number of people who were doing very diverse things. Some were worried about protecting a local natural area. Others were concerned by the terrible quality of the air or the water in the place where they were. Some were worried about pesticides. Others were worried about a freeway cutting through their vibrant inner-city neighborhood. And on and on. And each of them seemed to find a way to buy into this, and so we had this sense that we could actually weave all of these diverse strands into a fabric of a new value system that actually might have some political.
Mm-hmm.
But the downside was that almost none of them were interested in the concept of a teach-in. The college students thought it was terribly passé. We'd had our teach-ins in 64 and 65, and the people in the community wanted to lie down in front of the bulldozers, not have a public session. So we all got together. We hired an advertising firm to come up with a set of different names for this thing. And a very creative guy came back with what then became a full-page newspaper ad we ran in the New York Times. And it was, and then fill in the blank, it was Earth Day, : the beginning, or E-Day, the beginning, Ecology Day, the beginning, Environment Day, the beginning, Green Day, the beginning. And he himself recommended strongly Earth Day, in part because April 22nd was his birthday. But also when I pulled my whole staff together for pizza and beer and we laid out all these mocked-up ads, it was just clear among all of us that Earth Day was the one that would resonate. Mm. And it just became magical. And in fact, when we took the event international in 1990, it turns out that in every language that I've discussed this with someone in, Earth Day is absolutely transparent as to what it means, literally in every language in the earth.
I'm interviewing today Dennis Hayes, who's the president and CEO of the International Earth Day Network. Okay, so I've got two follow-on questions, if I may ask you. What was the budget allocated for that first Earth Day? And B, what actually did you all do on that Earth Day?
the budget was everything we could raise, and that turned out to be probably about $170,000 to $180,000. All of the staff that worked on it were paid a flat $4,500 a year, but most worked on it for a half year or less, so they were paid $2,000. My salary for the whole thing was under $3,000. So we stretched the money pretty far.
Mm.
What we did to organize, I mean, there obviously was no internet. We couldn't even really afford much in the way of telephones. We sent people out across the country. They always stayed with somebody that we were working with someplace. We didn't have hotels. A lot of it in the end was building the lists of key organizers and key places and communicating with them by telephone, and then a mailing list. We had something called an addressograph machine, which was you took these tin plates and you typed a name and address in it, and you put this whole tray full of these tin plates into a machine, and it would scoop one off at a time and address in ink all of the envelopes as somebody circulated the wheel that it was on. The guy that did that is now a United States senator.
Who is
a fellow named Fred Kent.
Right.
But it was terribly hands-on, incredibly grassroots, enormously underfunded, and spectacularly successful.
Okay, well, how was it successful? All this organizing led to what, teach-ins throughout the country at universities, or what actually happened on Earth Day?
Just about anything that you can imagine.
Oh.
The prime event was in New York City, where a Republican mayor, John Lindsay, but a very progressive Republican, was very upset with the president, Richard Nixon, who'd embarked upon a Southern strategy trying to shift the Republican Party into a reliance upon the most conservative parts of the United States and steal the South away from the Democrats, which had been consistently Democratic ever since the Civil War. And he was being quite successful. That was kind of freezing out what were sometimes referred to as the Rockefeller Republicans or the Lindsay Republicans. There was a whole set of people in New York and New England and a little bit in the Midwest up in Michigan who were very progressive in the Teddy Roosevelt vein.
Mm-hmm.
And so Lindsay saw this environment as a way that he could do something that got him a different position than Nixon's and with a popular new movement might begin to shift that pendulum a little bit. So he was just incredibly helpful. He shut down Fifth Avenue for the day and gave us the great lawn on Central Park. And the crowd in New York City was more than a million people.
Wow.
It was probably the largest planned and organized event up to that time in New York history. Actually, Earth Day 1990 in New York was estimated to be more than 2 million.
Huh.
At that point, a million people was just mind-boggling on this issue that nobody even understood 6 months earlier what it was. And that, of course, is also where we had the three television networks, NBC, ABC, CBS, that dominated the airwaves. We had the New York Times, the biggest newspaper, Time Magazine, Newsweek Magazine. It was the perfect anchor place for them to have all their correspondents from across the country feeding in stuff and then putting it together to sort of show the impact. It's generally, I think, credited by almost everybody as the first time that we pulled together the Rachel Carson concerns with pesticides, the anti-war concerns with the use of carcinogenic defoliants in Southeast Asia, the nuclear fallout from atmospheric testing concerns, along with people who were trying to worry about lead paint and rats in the ghetto, and stopping freeways from destroying their neighborhoods and saving local wetlands. And then the big one in much of the country then was air pollution, which was just getting worse and worse and worse each year. In the immediate aftermath, in the 3 years after Earth Day, we passed a Clean Air Act a few months later, and that was probably the most astonishing shift. This was a piece of legislation strenuously opposed by the automobile industry, the steel industry, the coal industry, the oil industry, the electric utility industry. The CEOs of the automobile companies walked arm in arm to every member of the relevant committee of the Senate and said, if you pass this bill, it will turn America into a third world nation. And the Senate passed it unanimously, and the House passed it on a voice vote. And then in the next couple of years, we passed the Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, Superfund to deal with toxics. It was the half a dozen other bills, Marine Mammal Protection Act, the Environmental Education Act. Stuff that came out those 3 years fundamentally changed the way that America does business. And I think it's I've never seen anybody do this tally, but I would expect that if you consider the amount of money spent by government, by the private sector, and by individuals, those 3 years have probably sent $15 or $20 trillion into directions that they otherwise would not have flowed, in ways that have made the world a much better place. It is literally the biggest social transformation in the United States since the New Deal.
Wow, that's, so you're an absolute pioneer, aren't you, Dennis?
Well, no, there was a whole pioneering generation. I had the good fortune to be in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, but, oh, it takes my breath away because I've done a bit of organizing myself over time. But what you did was absolutely stunning, changing laws left, right and center. So from that first 3 years after the first Earth Day in 1970, Dennis Hayes, what eventuated after that?
Well, it's an interesting thing. That all took place in Republican administrations, and part of it was people kind of rebelling against some anti-environmental policies of the Secretary of Interior and the Secretary of Commerce in the Nixon administration, who were both fairly ardently anti-environmental. When it got into the Carter years, a bunch of us were brought inside the government, and at that point, there started to be this perception that everything was pretty well taken care of. Now, Gus Beth moved inside, David Freeman moved inside. A great many people who'd been outside were at the reins of power. And a bit of the enthusiasm and the grassroots fervor was channeled into very, very local events and away from the national scene for several years. I think over the long run, and this is delicate, I want to try to say this carefully. In 1970, there was not a huge amount of sophistication among a lot of this stuff. I mean, people would read a study that says that breathing the air in Los Angeles is the equivalent of smoking two packs of cigarettes a day. And they realized that their two-month-old infant was breathing that air, and they sure didn't want their infant smoking two packs of cigarettes a day. And there was this huge emotional, visceral, intense kind of response. 40 years later, the movement now has an enormous degree of sophistication, PhDs in chemistry and biology and physics and economics, and, a huge number of environmental lawyers. And now the quality of research and analysis done is just worlds better than what we were doing then. But somehow in the process of all of it, some of that grassroots connection, some of that intensity was lost. And at least in American politics, intensity is really important. And the typical environmentalist is, a college-educated, relatively progressive person who, if they are looking at a political candidate, will wonder, well, what does he think about the war in the Middle East? What does he think about health care? What does he think ought to be done about regulating Wall Street? What does he think about the environment? What is it? But it's that huge balancing act. And the people who are able to shift policy dramatically tend to be the single-issue zealots who want to be able to carry firearms into the local coffee shop or who are really very intense on the abortion issue or something. And you don't see much of that in environmental politics.
No. Well, I suppose it's because partly it's moved, as you said, into more sophisticated areas. And I think maybe subliminally people feel that it's to a degree being taken care of. But I just got, incidentally, I'm interviewing Dennis Hayes, who is the president and CEO of the International Earth Day Network. I just got an article from my friend Harvey Wasserman. Do you know Harvey?
Oh, sure.
Yes, and he's been working against nuclear power since really the days of Seabrook in the
exactly.
70s. But this article really disturbed me. He said the climate bill is due on Earth Day. By all accounts, it will be a nuclear bomb. It will be the ultimate challenge of the global grassroots green movement to transform it into something that can actually save the planet. For the atomic power industry, the bill will cap a decade-long 640 million-plus virtual cleansing of its radioactive image. We'll have the Obama administration, Senators John Kerry, Joe Lieberman and Lindsey Graham embracing a very substantial taxpayer subsidies for building new nuclear power plants, and the same goes for new offshore drilling and clean coal. The markets have been laid for greenwashed business-as-usual approach toward pretending to deal with global climate change and the life-threatening pollution in which our corporate power structure is drowning us, all without actually threatening certain corporate profits. Now, he says it's going to take, you know, much of this will take place or begin on Earth Day, which is April the 22nd. It really took my breath away. I mean, I knew this was coming up. I knew that the Lieberman-Kerry-Graham bill wants to allocate almost an unlimited amount to nuclear power, $100 billion or more, and that Obama has suddenly come out for offshore drilling. And there seems to be no evidence, even though James Hansen is screaming for coal not to be burnt anymore for electricity production, there's an unwillingness or inertia in the political climate, particularly in the United States, but everywhere else, including my country, Australia, which deems us to head in exactly the opposite direction to the way we should be heading to save life on the planet. And particularly it's coming up at this Earth Day celebration. So what's your take on that, Dennis Hayes?
Well, let me deal with the really small, easy thing first and then dig into the much tougher nut. It certainly will not be announced on Earth Day. They know that this would lead to widespread condemnation and Lindsey Graham himself in a colorful thing just a few days ago was saying that he didn't know where those rumors came from, but it certainly wasn't going to happen. They might create a new day called Happy Offshore Drilling Day, and that's when they'd release it. The tougher nut, and I might also say, and this I hope will appeal to you in your gender, is that there's an alternative bill in the United States called the Cantwell-Collins Bill, two women senators, one from Washington and one from Maine, that is a vastly better piece of legislation. But unfortunately, it does not have widespread support among their colleagues. This is one of those things where there's been this effort to move on climate ever since Rio de Janeiro. And, you know, some of us who've been paying attention to this issue from way back in the time that the National Center for Atmospheric Research started publishing Steve Schneider's work in the mid-1970s. The National Academy of Sciences in 1979 said, you have to get serious about it. And people have been thwarted time after time after time by the enormous power of these industries. Democrats in states that are dominated by the coal industry, including usually progressive ones like Jay Rockefeller, will lose office if he votes for something that will hurt the coal industry. Thus, he's peeled off. And the Republicans are with almost no exceptions anymore. The Richard Nixon Southern strategy was hugely effective, and they are basically controlled by the interests of big oil. So it's a situation where people trying to figure out how to get some kind of bill passed that would put some kind of a cap on carbon have compromised. And it's been going on now for some decades until finally you have a bill that would have a cap, but not a terribly effective one, that would give away in the first years like 85% of the permits for carbon, that would not control mobile sources, at least initially, just stationary sources, that would allow certain kinds of trading credits that seem to me to be almost a sham, and do provide boosts for clean coal and for nuclear in ways that I think are enormously worrisome, especially for people like us who care a lot about proliferation and a big U.S. commitment to nuclear. Pretty much makes it impossible for us to become a bulwark against the proliferation of power plants and then with it the proliferation of knowledgeability and fissionable materials around the world. Mm-hmm. So this is all scary, but the inside the Beltway in Washington, D.C., the so-called revealed truth is you cannot pass a bill unless you can get coal state Democrats and pro-nuclear Republicans, at least enough to get 60 votes. My own attitude is that what we need to do is not change the legislation, but change the politics. I would rather go back and have nothing at all this year, but come back with something like Cantwell-Collins, which itself has flaws. It tiptoes into the issue rather than cannonballing into the middle of the pool, which I think is what's appropriate now. But that itself, I think, might make it easier to pass. At least it's got a structure that as years go on, and not that many of them, it gets tougher and tougher. It's got a real cap. It auctions all of the carbon permits. It puts them very far upstream, wherever carbon enters the economy, not trying to control tailpipes and smokestacks. So it's got all of, and it takes 75% of all of the money that's obtained from these, the auctioning of these carbon permits, and returns it to the people on a pro rata basis. And since an upstream auction of those permits captures all the direct and indirect energy use, so that it's sort of proportional to income. Rich people, if you capture the direct and indirect energy use, use proportionally more energy than poor people do. But if all of that revenue is returned proportionally, then they put in more revenue but get back just the same amount, making it a progressive measure. So all sorts of desirable things, and if we could build a constituency for that, I think it's, it would be the answer. My fear is that that may not happen. Politics here are pretty terrible.
I know, but it seems to me, Dennis, I mean, the way you organized way back was by education. The way I and my fellow colleagues, physicians, organized was by massive education. When we started in 78, most people in America said, it's better to be dead than red. And so we started doing what we call the bombing run and illustrating the potential devastating consequences of nuclear war. And within 5 years, people really got it, and 80% of Americans opposed the concept of nuclear war and wanted the arms race to end. And that helped to bring about the end of the Cold War. But it was only through those two massive grassroots movements, if you will, with the passion that yours originally did have in the 70s, and the passion that we saw with a million people in Central Park in 1982, that in fact forced the politicians to take everything seriously. And without that incredible democratic action that we sort of learnt about actually in the 60s in America, the politicians are in the pocket of the corporations who are destroying the planet, right?
Yeah. Being really candid, we caught them off guard. I mean, when this whole thing hit in the early 70s, on up through the 80s, we were often going after companies on the basis of things that they'd not been attacked on before and had a real difficult way figuring out how to respond.
Yeah.
Because they would be criticized not just by people out on the streets, but by their own colleagues in the country clubs. It's, you know, what are you doing? Sort of putting that toxic waste out into the water. on this issue, they've been fighting this now for a very long time.
Yep.
There is no way for the coal industry to lose and to remain viable, so they will spend whatever it takes to win and be as ruthless as it takes
and,
to win.
And to destroy the earth. Yep, they are.
And my great hope on all of this is... it's a little bit vague, but although they can outspend us dramatically, I think the Internet may prove to be an enormous leveling device.
Mm.
And the hope here is that we can actually use this in a way that, that pulls together the grassroots in a way not unlike that first Earth Day where you're not spending an awful lot of money, but you're getting an incredible amount of bang per buck.
Yeah, and the way Obama used it, in fact, to win his election. That
indeed
was very much... And I'm now setting up a similar thing. It's called the Helen Caldicott Foundation for a Nuclear-Free Planet, but we're going to move in to see if we can penetrate the lives and brains of Generation X, Y, and Z, because they don't tend to read newspapers nor listen to the news. They Twitter, they blog, they dig, they, you know, go to Facebook. So we're going to extend blogging into all those areas and maybe do YouTubes, which hopefully might be taken viral. You know, within a day, a million people have seen this three-minute YouTube thing. I mean, I think, and I agree with you, that this is probably the new and only way we can now arouse a massive grassroots movement of people whose future lies ahead of them, who are young. We're old now. You know, I'm 72, but it's their future.
Mm-hmm. No, and in fact, if you and your listeners go to just www.earthday.org, you'll see a whole bunch of our early efforts to do this. We have our Earth Day TV, where we have streaming videos of all of a number of movies that are available,
mm-hmm.
a whole bunch of YouTube links, a number of social networking opportunities for people to get together around common causes.
Mm.
I think this really is the wave of the future.
Oh, I do too. Now, before you go, and I know you need to go, Dennis, because you've got things to do and it's late for you, you've got a tremendous paragraph on the most worrisome environmental problem, human population growth. It says if everyone currently in the world aspires to consume at the same level as the average Swede does, the human population already exceeds the planet's carrying capacity, with humans accounting directly and indirectly for 40% of the Earth's net biological productivity. We are squeezing other species into extinction at a catastrophic rate. But because the population issue is inextricably linked to such political third rails as immigration, abortion, racism, religious objections, contraception, and social security, our politicians resolutely ignore it.
Couldn't have said it better.
Did you say
no, it clearly is a exactly as I wrote that 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah.
So your researcher is really terrific. It is something where I was part of the delegation from the United States to the population conference in Cairo, and the religious vehemence of the Catholics and the Islamic leaders there to any kind of addressing of this issue was just mind-numbing. And in a democracy where you have identity politics, if one group holds its percentage of the population steady, then it is going to be in a minority status forever. So there's even a bit of almost breeding for political power.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that historically has been a basis for armies, particularly if you find yourself in a country such as China, where for all kinds of reasons, but the one dominant one having to do with population control, the number of young men dramatically outnumber the number of young women. And the complexities just abound, but it's if you think of the amount of material that is in the Earth's crust that is valuable for human purposes and the amount of absorptive capacity of the atmosphere, there are a certain number of kind of what you might think of as human life units that the world is going to be able to have. And there are ways that you can structure that so it will be pretty sustainable and rejuvenating. But when you go beyond that very far, you rather rapidly follow the classic ecological paradigm into collapse. It's all the way back to the limits of growth kind of thing, all the way back to a form of Malthus. But the basic principles are clearly true, and I'm afraid we've passed some of those limits already. And the concept of moving to a world of 9 billion people, if you get there, among other things, in a globalized economy, I think one of the slippery things that has constantly been said gets taken away, which is people always say, well, yeah, there's a big difference between the rich and the poor, but we're all growing, so we are all relatively better off. When you move into something where you can no longer grow, and the population nonetheless is growing, then suddenly this redistributive function becomes pretty important in a world where everyone is sort of hostage to everyone else, and of course becomes pretty potentially catastrophic in a world where 40 countries have nuclear weapons,
mm-hmm.
perhaps 6 or 7 terrorist groups have them, and a couple of criminal gangs have them. That gets very frightening very fast.
Yeah, now is a human life unit a human being, is it?
I beg your pardon?
Is a human life unit that you just referred to, is that a human being?
Yes, but it's something that takes not just a person as a person, but a person as something that consumes at the level mm-hmm. of a Chinese peasant or consumes at the level of a U.S. investment banker. I mean, if everybody in the world was content to live as Chinese peasants, we would not have too much difficulty, I believe, supporting 8 or 9 billion people. But even Chinese peasants don't want to live like Chinese peasants anymore.
That's right.
So as you move into anything that approximates what we think of as, you know, an Australian standard of living, then we are vastly past that.
I think
capacity
so.
Already.
And I just want to end with reading something from Robert Kennedy that is also on your website, Dennis Hayes, for you to comment briefly, and then we'll end this conversation. Robert F. Kennedy said, "The gross national product includes air pollution and advertising for cigarettes and ambulances to clear our highways of carnage. It counts special locks for our doors and jails for the people who break them. The gross national product includes the destruction of the redwoods and the death of Lake Superior. It grows with the production of napalm and missiles and nuclear warheads. And if the gross national product includes all this, there is much that it does not comprehend. It does not allow for the health of our families, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. It's indifferent to the decency of our factories and safety of our streets alike. It does not include the beauty of our poetry or the strength of our marriages, the intelligence of our public debate, or the integrity of our public officials. The gross national product measures neither our wit nor our courage, neither our wisdom nor our learning, neither our compassion nor our devotion to country. It measures everything, in short, except that which makes life worthwhile, and it can tell us everything about America, except why we are proud that we are Americans."
Yeah, there are people who think of history as these vast, inexorable forces, and that the roles of individual people are irrelevant.
Mm.
But every now and then there are people that do make a difference, not just as a vehicle for some social movement, but out of a certain integrity that they bring to things. He uttered all of those words actually 2 years before the first Earth Day. So,
oh, really?
He and candidly his speechwriter were very prescient. And it's absolutely true. His assassination is one of the tragedies.
Tragedies.
And anybody that also thinks there's no difference in the world whether the Supreme Court had allowed Al Gore to take over the presidency that he actually won, or George Bush. I mean, of course, just an enormous difference that came out of that decision.
I totally agree. And this Earth Day, just briefly, Dennis, what is going to happen specifically in the United States to celebrate this Earth Day?
Well, there will be things going on in thousands of communities, and probably on the order of 70,000 K-12 schools. So there'll be 30, 40 million kids involved in one kind of environmental activity or another in this country. There will be things of various kinds going on in other countries. One of the classics this year will be Morocco, where the king of Morocco is going to issue a proclamation essentially guaranteeing Moroccans a right to a safe, healthy environment, which is kind of a remarkably progressive idea. And we'll also be announcing how they're going to be spending $9 billion on new renewable energy projects. $9 billion is serious money in Morocco, so we're very pleased about that.
Well, Dennis.
And in the United States, we'll be having a giant climate rally on Sunday the 25th, where we'll have possible cross-section. You mentioned Jim Hansen. He will be there, as well as a number of climate scientists and climate policy analysts and civil rights leaders and religious leaders. And
where will that be?
That'll be on the Mall outside the Capitol building.
Okay, in Washington, D.C. What day again?
Sunday, April 25th.
Excellent. So as many people as can who are listening to this program, make your way to Washington, D.C. on April the 26th. And help us to save this wonderful planet of ours. And Dennis, I really appreciate very much what you've done in your life. You're an absolute pioneer. May you long continue, and may we walk in your footsteps.
Well, Ellen, you've long been on a pedestal to a great many of us for the strength of character and the intelligence that you've brought to so many issues, and particularly the nuclear issue. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you very much, Dennis. My guest on If You Love This Planet today was Dennis Hayes, President and CEO of the International Earth Day Network, which is now global. We will now be excerpting a segment of a speech I gave in Vermont at St. Michael's College in Burlington in 2010. The reason we will be playing this speech is because many corporations and governments of the world propose that one of the answers to global warming and fossil fuel use is nuclear power. This speech specifically addresses the inherent dangers, profound inherent dangers, of nuclear power, with specific reference to Vermont Yankee, an aging, dilapidated reactor in Vermont, the so-called Green State. All right, so let's go back to the nuclear fuel cycle. The uranium in Australia is crushed. The ore is crushed using more fossil fuel. It's then turned into uranium to yellow cake. It's yellow. I just went, like your jacket, I just went to a uranium mine run by BHP Billiton in Western Australia, on Aboriginal tribal land, of course, and they had cores from the ore itself, and you could see the uranium. It was glowed sort of greeny yellow like that. And they gave me a Geiger counter. And as we came in the bus, the Geiger counter started going tick, 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 tick. And it went right off scale when I put it next to these cores. It's really scary. Okay, now, so the uranium is turned into yellow cake, put in drums and sent to Paducah, Kentucky. So where it's enriched. It's turned into uranium hexafluoride gas and forced through tiny micropore holes in a series, a cascade of huge nickel plates, thousands of them. So you force the uranium through, on one side says 238 because it's a larger atom, and the other side collects 235. So by a cascade of these filters, you end up with uranium 235 enriched 2-3%. Okay, now, it takes a huge amount of energy to do this, so they have 2 1,500 megawatt large ones, coal fire plants, to provide the electricity to enrich the uranium. But don't forget, nuclear power is clean, green, sustainable and cheap. And it doesn't produce any CO2. So, in other words, it's undergirded by a huge infrastructure, industrial infrastructure, that makes huge amount of CO2. The other thing is that there are hundreds of miles of pipes containing uranium hexafluoride, which is thermally hot. Beside them are pipes containing CFC gas, which, what does it do? Ozone, damages the ozone. That's why we have the highest incidence of skin cancer and melanoma in the world. In Australia, I've had a melanoma because the ozone's very thin. So under the Montreal Protocol, CFC gas was banned. Except the nuclear industry was, quotes, grandfathered out of the Montreal Protocol. I never knew what grandfathering meant till I came to America and heard that strange term. So they're allowed to use it. So 93% of the CFC gas released in America per year, CFC-114 gas, comes from the uranium enrichment plant. Well, not only does it destroy the ozone, but it's 10,000 to 20,000 times more potent as a global heat trapper than carbon dioxide. But don't forget, nuclear power doesn't cause global warming, says James Lovelock, Patrick Moore, Stuart Brandt, James Hansen, Governor Douglas. All right, now this nickel's pretty expensive stuff, but it's radioactive. It becomes activated and gives off gamma radiation, but, you know, it's expensive. So what the nuclear industry has done is coined a term below regulatory concern, and they say this needn't be regulated because we're not concerned, so they recycle it into children's teeth braces, hip replacements, jewellery, belt buckles, knives and forks, and furniture. So you don't know if you're dealing with radioactive materials or not. Some scrap metal companies do have Geiger counters and they pick it up. Don't trust anyone, particularly don't trust the Nuclear Regulatory Commission that is run and paid for by the nuclear industry. It's not independent. It's a parasite of the industry. Okay, so when the uranium has been enriched at great expense and great energy, it's turned into pellets like this bit of chalk, just that little bit of chalk, ceramic pellets, by a very big industrial process. They use huge numbers of chemicals in the industry. Then it's packed into a fuel rod, 12 feet long and half an inch thick, made of zirconium.
And then, so along to a reactor, here we come to Vermont Yankee, is packed 100 tons of uranium in the core, interspersed by moderating rods made of boron, which moderate the flux of neutrons. It's immersed in water, and as the boron slowly lifted out, so the uranium reaches critical mass, the atoms start breaking apart as they're hit by neutrons. 200 new man-made elements are made, all radioactive. Some last seconds, some last millions of years. The energy released is E equals MC squared, the same as nuclear weapons. So you lift out the rods, it reaches critical mass, and huge heat is induced, which boils the water. The steam is taken off, which turns a turbine, which generates electricity. So all a nuclear power plant does is boil water. As Einstein once said, nuclear power's a hell of a way to boil water. Okay, now, it uses 1 million gallons a minute of cooling water from the Connecticut River. That water goes back relatively radioactive with tritium in it anyway, every day, every minute of every day. It routinely releases radioactive materials into the air, and I'll get into that in a minute. Global warming is antithetical to nuclear power, because in France, when they had a heat wave some years ago, the rivers fell, the water was too hot, and they had to close the reactors because they couldn't keep them cool, A. B, a lot of reactors are built at a sea level, and the seas are rising, the Greenland ice cap is melting, the Arctic ice is melting, great huge icebergs are breaking off from the Antarctic as the oceans rise, and there are freak storms, so the control rooms will be flooded and there'll be meltdowns. But don't you know, nuclear power is the answer to global warming. There's only enough uranium in the world for the next 10 or 20 years till we run out. You've got 130 reactors, 103, all of which are reaching the end of their life, like Vermont Yankee, which has reached the end of its life. I mean, it's unbelievable. That's Cree. It's unbelievable that, you know, a cooling tower collapses. Duh. Oh, the cooling tower's collapsed. Then you had a fire in a transformer or something like that. And then they, I don't know why they even dug holes to find what was in the water under the reactor, but it's all tritiated. It's got tritium in it. Tritium lasts for 120 years. It's one of the most potent mutagenic materials known to the human race. It's a soft beta emitter. It causes brain cancer, cancers in various organs of the body, causes abnormalities in the offspring, and genetic disease. But don't worry, because it's only radioactive hydrogen. That's what the industry says, H3. It combines with oxygen to form tritiated water. So if you live near the reactor on an inversion system like today, fog, so you're immersed in fog, the tritium goes straight through your skin. Skin lets nothing through. It's the most important organ of our body. That's why people who have severe burns die, because they lose their body fluids and get infected. Tritium gets in by inhalation. It also bioconcentrates in food around the reactor. Well, I went down there to Vernon, and there are farms all around with cows. So the tritium lands on the ground, bioconcentrates by orders of magnitude in the grass. The cows eat the grass. I can't draw a cow. But that's the main organ. The cows eat the grass and it bioconcentrates in the milk. And, you know, then I suppose it goes into cheese and it lasts for 100 years. So it's medically contraindicated to have farms anywhere near a nuclear power plant, because continuously they emit tritium. The only thing that stops the escape of tritium is gold. It's so dense it doesn't let, but it gets out of glass, stainless steel, you name it. It gets out of everything. Never have a watch with a tritiated face that you can see at night, because the tritium escapes from the watch. Tritium is in exit signs. It's on signs on the runways, in the airports, and the like and the like. Tritiated water. Okay, so I've got actually an article here on tritium for any medical people in the audience. If you want to come up afterwards, it's published by Beyond Nuclear with 22 references. The nuclear industry is so scared of tritium, they've done hundreds of studies on it in rats and mice and stuff, but they tell us that don't worry, it's safe. You can't clean it up. I hear that they've stopped the leak in one pipe. Okay, anyone in the audience know how many pipes there are underneath Vermont Yankee? There must be hundreds of them. They only found seven that they didn't know they had? Because probably the people who designed the thing are dead anyway, because it's been going for 40 years. You can't get tritium out of the water, the underground water. You can't get it out of the Connecticut River. So they're lying to you. A, they said there weren't any pipes, and then they said, oh, there is, yeah, one pipe's leaking, don't worry. And they put a robot in there, and I thought, I don't know how it plugged up the leak with mud. I don't know. But you can't get the tritium out of the water. You can't. The other thing that is routine released from reactors, and they say, don't worry, they're routine emissions. It's like routinely being x-rayed. We have to give you an x-ray every day. Look, it's just routine. What are the gases? Krypton, argon, and xenon. Krypton reminds me of Superman. Lots of you weren't alive when there were Superman comics, but Krypton was in Superman. And they're noble gases. They don't combine biochemically in the body, but they're absorbed through the lung, and they're very fat soluble, so they tend to concentrate in the abdominal fat pad and upper thighs. What's located near the abdominal fat pad and upper thighs? Reproductive organs. Right, you get a prize. So these are very high energy gamma emitters like X-rays. So people who live near the reactor are exposed to argon, krypton and xenon. Krypton decays to strontium 90, which causes bone cancer and leukemia. Xenon decays to cesium-137. I'll get onto that in a minute. Now, guess what? There's a primary school right opposite Vermont Yankee. Hands up those people in the audience who knew that. Yeah, apparently the utility built it. That's criminal. I mean, all the pediatricians in this state should be rising up because children are 10 to 20 times more sensitive to radiation than adults. Is there an increase in malignancy in that school? There must be. If you take the German study as standard, there must be an increase. I mean, fancy sending your child to a school next to a nuclear reactor and running the risk of your child getting leukemia. I don't know if you know what it's like to tell a couple of parents their child has leukemia. It's just hideous.
You have been listening to an excerpt from a speech I gave at St. Michael's College in Burlington, Vermont in March 2010. I thank you for listening to If You Love This Planet. If you want more information or would like to contribute to these efforts of our broadcasting, please go to ifyoulovethisplanet.org, and we'll be talking with you next week. Bye-bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.